Well, 51 years ago, former Beatle John Lennon and his wife Yoko Ono published the song Imagine. It would become the number one hit of Lennon's solo career. The music to Imagine is pleasant to the ear, but the lyrics, let's take a look at them. All right, next slide. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us, only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. So they want us to imagine atheism is true, there's no afterlife, and let's just live our life for today. Don't think about eternity or anything, because this life is all there is. All right, next slide. Imagine there are no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And, of course, no religion, too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. So just put aside your worldviews. Put aside whether you're an atheist, agnostic, Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, Jew, whatever. Just put that all aside. You don't need it anymore. And there's no need to be a patriot toward your country. Let's just all just have one world and we can all live in peace. Capitalists, communists, and even the Taliban. Next slide. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. These lyrics, as naive as they are, were meant to persuade, as Lennon himself acknowledged. He said, the song is anti-religious, anti-nationalistic, anti-conventional, anti-capitalistic, but because it is sugar-coated, it is accepted. Now I understand what you have to do. Put your political message across with a little honey. Okay. Now, I'd like to take up Lenin's challenge for a moment, and I want to imagine that there is no God. I want to imagine that there is no afterlife. This life is all there is. And I would like to take a moment and address the young ladies in this church who are here today. Now, I live in Atlanta, where it's the human trafficking capital of the U.S. And so I want you to imagine, though I'm sure it happens up here in Northern Virginia and the whole D.C. metro area as well, I want you to imagine that you're enjoying life and things are going well for you. And then one day you're out taking a walk and a van pulls up beside you. Two guys jump out. They grab you, throw you into the van and drive you just out into the country somewhere to a warehouse where you are raped. And from that point on, consigned to the role of a sex slave. From all your dreams now, from this point on, all your hopes to have a family or to have a career or whatever, to just have a normal life, they're forever gone. From this hour on, your sole purpose in life will be to satisfy the sexual lusts of others. Now, hopefully this will never happen to you, but it is the nightmare that many women and children in the world right now are living. If God does not exist, then there is no one to hear their cries. There is no one to answer them. There is no one who is ever going to bring the bad guys to justice. I think about people like Mother Teresa, who sacrificed the comforts of life in order to be with the poor and the destitute, in order to minister to them and to make their lives a little bit better. If God does not exist, then goodness will not be rewarded. And then I think about death. Now, we have a dog right now. Next slide. We have a dog. She is just amazing. Her name is Piper. She's 3 years old. And we got her just 2 weeks after we had to euthanize our other dog, which was similar, a West Highland Terrier. Her name was Nessie. I can't put up Nessie's photograph because it would just bother me too much. We had her for 16 and a half years, and we loved that dog, and she loved us, and she just grew old, and she was in pain, and she had diabetes, and she got to a point where she didn't want to eat anymore, And we knew, and she stopped eating, and then we knew it was time. We took her to the vet to have her put down. And so I held the dog. There was a table, and the vet had me hold her up, and the family is there and in this room. And he put some kind of solution in her to cause her to fall asleep. And so I laid her down, and I'm petting her. And then he put some more something else in her, a chemical, to cause her heart to stop. And then he put the stethoscope on her and listened for a heartbeat and said, she's gone. And all of us in the room were just crying. And my wife will tell you that I've only cried about five in our 35 years of marriage and a year and a half of dating, that she's only seen me cry about a half dozen times. And two of those are when my parents died. And she'll tell you that I cried more when that dog died than all the other four of them combined. And it's not because I love the dog more. It's because in the case of the other four that had died, they knew the Lord. And so I had a confidence I was going to see them again. But with my dog, I didn't have such confidence. It's like, well, maybe pets will be in heaven. C.S. Lewis thought that they would be. Maybe they will be, but I have no promise from Scripture. And the thought that this dog that we loved so much and had lived with us for 16 and a half years, that she had breathed her last and would cease to exist for all eternity, that she lived, was loved, and was gone forever. It was a crushing weight. And it's like, wow, if this is the way it is with a pet, how much more it is horrible it would be to lose a loved one, someone you, a spouse, a child, a parent, a sibling, that you lose them and to think you'll never, ever see them again. They just cease to exist. If God does not exist, injustices will be unanswered, goodness will be unrewarded, and death is final. To imagine such is a horrible, it's a horrific thought. I sincerely hope it is false. But there's another side to that coin, and it goes like this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And God loved the world so much that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him will not perish, but will have everlasting life. Now that's really good news, isn't it? If it's true. But how will we know if it's true? I mean, we've just been brought up to be Christians, right? A lot of us have. Some of you have become Christians from another worldview. But a lot of us have been brought. How do we know Christianity is true? Well, critics of Jesus in his day asked the same question. How do we know that you are who you claim to be? Because Jesus went around claiming to be God's uniquely divine son. He said that God had chosen him to usher in his kingdom. He said that our eternal destiny was directly linked to how we respond to him. Now, can you imagine if Pastor Rodenheiser, who, by the way, he was just when I was here, he was a fantastic pastor. And so I'm sure you guys love him just as much. And now that he's got a few more years behind his under his skin, I'll bet you that he's even better now than he was when I was here. I'm hoping I'm a better man, but he was a great man back then. How do we know that it's true? But if he started to claim that he was God's uniquely divine son, that our salvation was directly linked to how we respond to him, we would think he was a few French fries short of a Happy Meal, right? And so Jesus' critics had similar thoughts, and they said, show us a sign. And Jesus said, well, for just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And then in John chapter 2, after cleansing the temple, overturning the tables in it and chasing out the money changers, he says, the Jews said to him, what sign do you show us for doing these things? And Jesus answered, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And they said to him, it's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? but he was speaking about the temple of his body. So Jesus said, I'll give you one sign that I am who I'm claiming, my resurrection. So if Jesus did not rise from the dead, that makes him a false prophet whom no rational person should follow. Why should you get up on Easter morning or any other Sunday morning and come to church and worship someone who isn't really there? But if Jesus did rise from the dead, he did so in confirmation of his personal radical claims, and that gives us something very serious to consider. So I want to look at this and the evidence for the resurrection, and we're going to start off and make this really simple. In fact, I'm going to make this so simple that even a Southern Baptist can understand. I'm Southern Baptist. I go to Southern Baptist Church. I worked for the North American Mission Board for 6 years, 7 years. So I have the right to say such a thing. So we're going to start off with a simple fact that is undisputed amongst scholars today. And when I say undisputed, I'm talking about not only conservative, evangelical scholars, I'm talking about moderate, liberal scholars, agnostic, atheist, Jewish scholars who study about Jesus. They're historians of Jesus. Virtually everyone will agree on this, okay? And that is that Jesus' disciples, his apostles, after his death, they claimed Jesus rose and had appeared to them. He rose from the dead and appeared to them. So that's what I mean by apostles claim Jesus appeared. They were claiming that he rose from the dead and had appeared to them. Now notice I'm not saying here that Jesus rose and appeared to them. That's not what the fact I'm saying here. I'm not even saying at this point that they believed it. I'm just saying the very simple fact that Jesus' apostles claimed that he rose from the dead and had appeared to them. And again, this is something that virtually every scholar who studies the subject grants, including skeptics. Now, I know that there are a few out there who would say Jesus never existed, but folks, even Richard Carrier, who kind of leads this movement, a few years ago, he said he only knew of 7 scholars in the world. 7. Who say that Jesus never existed. 7 out of thousands and thousands, 7. That's it. And serious scholars do not pay attention to them. They are regarded as like Holocaust deniers and flat earthers. They just don't give them any serious consideration. So, but everyone else will agree that the apostles claim that Jesus rose and appeared to them. Now, why do they say this? Let me give you a few reasons. 1 Corinthians 15, chapter 15, this is an undisputed letter of Paul. Now, there are 13 letters attributed to Paul in our New Testament. When you take all the New Testament scholars together, and I'm talking about from conservative Christian to atheist, this is what I'm talking about when I say scholars, okay? They're all in agreement that 1 Corinthians was written by Paul. They dispute some of the other letters in the New Testament, whether Paul wrote them, but 1 Corinthians, everyone agrees Paul wrote it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul says, I delivered to you what I also received. Now, when did he deliver it? When did he receive? Most scholars think that 1 Corinthians was written somewhere between the years 53 and 57, and that Paul had established his church in Corinth around 51. The First Baptist Church of Corinth. And so he delivered it to them in the year 51. This is oral tradition he's given them. He delivered it to them in 51, what he received beforehand. When did he receive it? We really don't know, but probably no later than 50, and almost certainly much earlier, and almost certainly he received it from the Jerusalem apostles who had known Jesus. So we have some very early oral tradition here that predates the writing of any of the New Testament literature. There are even atheist scholars who say that this tradition that Paul is giving here goes way back to within 1 to 3 years of the crucifixion. Another New Testament scholar, James D.G. Dunn, says we could be entirely confident that it was formulated within 6 months of Jesus' death. Now, I don't know how they get those dates, to be honest with you, and they don't even tell us. All I know is if I'm trying to be really careful here and only go with what the evidence can bear out, We know it was by the year 50, within 20 years or less of the crucifixion, and probably much closer to the crucifixion. And here's what it is. He's getting this from the apostles, and he says, Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared. Now, I want you to notice something here. Do you notice the format of this? It's long, short, long, short. That's called parallelism, and that was something the ancients would do to assist in memory. So today, if I said, amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. You know, I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. You'd say, well, that's kind of a hymn or a poem or something. Why? Because there's a rhythm to it and there's rhyme at the end. Well, the ancients didn't do that, but they would do other things like parallelism, long, short, long, short. It was to assist in memory. So number one, you've got delivered and received, which talks about oral tradition. Then you have the parallelism, which also suggests that this is an early Christian creed that comes from the apostles. And then later on, Paul says, whether I or they, this is what we preached, and this is what you believed. When he uses that word preached, the Greek word is kerygma, or we'd say kerygma in English, which means the official, formal, public proclamation. So this is what the apostles were preaching. Christ's death, burial, resurrection, and appearances. And then Paul goes on to name some of these appearances. To Peter, to the 12, to more than 500 at one time. And then Paul adds, most of these people are still alive, although a few have died, suggesting that, hey, they're still around. You can talk to them. Then to James, then to all the apostles. And then Paul says, last of all, is to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. Three individual appearances, three group appearances. We'll get back to that. The group appearances are, there's something significant about that. Then, like I said, Paul says, whether I or they, the other apostles, this is what we preached, and this is what you believed. So Paul is saying that he and the apostles are proclaiming the death, burial, resurrection, and resurrection appearances of Jesus to them. To individuals, to groups, to friend and foe alike. Okay? So we know Paul is claiming it as an apostle. And then, next one, we have oral tradition. So you have this creed I just mentioned, that's oral tradition. So number one, you got Paul who's saying this, and he's an apostle, and he's saying the other apostles are saying it. And you got the creed, and then you've got speeches in the book of Acts. Now, scholars don't all agree on what the speeches are, like whether they were actually, this is what was said on the particular occasion to which these speeches are attributed, but they do seem to agree that when we're looking at these speeches in Acts, like Acts 2, 10, 13, and 17, this is the kerygma. This is an encapsulation, sermon summaries of what the apostles were proclaiming. And they are summaries, they're not transcripts of what they said on that occasion. It was number one, they didn't have recorders. Number two, shorthand was in its infancy stages, and the best secretaries at that point that learned how to do shorthand were in Rome. So they are, and you can read these speeches within usually 5 minutes. And I mean, when was the last time you heard a speech or a sermon that was only 5 minutes long? You know, right? So what you're looking at here, when we read these speeches in the book of Acts, we're reading summaries of what the apostles, their apostolic message. Okay? And then we go with written tradition. And we have all four gospels that talk about the appearances of Jesus. Or in Mark, there aren't really appearances reported, but they certainly, Mark has Jesus predicting the appearances, at least where the first one's going to occur. And then you've got a guy named Clement of Rome. And Clement of Rome was, and Polycarp, they were both known as what are called the Apostolic Fathers. I don't know why scholars refer to them as the Apostolic Fathers, because that seems to be thinking about the apostles. But it's not the apostles. It's those who came after the apostles, the church leaders who came after. And Clement of Rome ended up being a bishop of Rome. Polycarp was a leader and I think he was Bishop of Smyrna, which is present-day Izmir, Turkey. And Polycarp was martyred for the Lord, and he very likely was a disciple of the Apostle John. Clement of Rome may have been a disciple of the Apostle Peter. And they mention the appearances of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus. So in all, we've got 9 sources here, and if you want to know how to remember that, there's the anachronism there, POW, P-O-W, Paul, oral tradition, and written tradition. So if someone were to say, well, how do we know the disciples were claiming that Jesus rose and appeared to them? Well, first of all, you got Paul, then you have oral tradition, the creed, and the Acts sermon summaries, and then you've got 4 Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and then you also have Clement of Rome and Polycarp who talk about it. And you say, well, but Mike, these are all Christian sources. It's the Christians that are, we're not saying the resurrection here is true. We're not even saying they believed it. We're just saying they're claiming it, right? And so if we want to know if the Christians are claiming Jesus rose from the dead, we've got Christian sources claiming Jesus rose from the dead. I mean, it's not a big deal here, folks. You know, it's like, okay. All right. Everyone, all the historians out there, again, no matter how skeptical, grant that Jesus' apostles were claiming he rose from the dead and appeared to them. Where do we go from there? We start to form a logic tree. And say, all right, if they're claiming Jesus rose and appeared to them, that leaves us with 2 options. He either appeared to them or he did not appear to them. Can you think of any other option? There are no others. It's like, hey, you're in church today or you are not in church today. Can you think of another option? Okay, this is real simple stuff. So let's just go then with the option that he did not appear to them. Okay, now we look at 2 other options. They either thought he appeared to them or they did not think he appeared to them. Can you think of another option? There are no other options. All right. Let's focus then on they thought he appeared. So they claim, Jesus' disciples claimed he rose and appeared to them. He did not appear to them, but they truly thought he appeared to them. Okay? So now we're looking at 2 options. They were either hallucinating or Jesus had an identical twin. All right, let's look at hallucinations for a moment. Hallucinations are false sensory perceptions. You are having the sensation, you think you are perceiving something with one of your natural senses, but that thing isn't really there. So we think of hallucinations as a visual thing, right? You think you're seeing something that isn't there. But there are other modes of hallucinations. There are auditory hallucinations. You think you're hearing something, but it's not there. Or smelling something, that's called an olfactory hallucination. Or tasting something, gustatory hallucination. Or maybe you have a kinesthetic hallucination. You have the sense of motion. It's like when you're dreaming and you dream that you're falling and you wake up. That is called a kinesthetic hallucination. Or you remember when you got your first mobile phone and you came to church or you're sitting in school and you put it on vibrate, silence, and you're in class or sermon and you think you got a message. You think you heard or felt it, and you pulled it out and you looked at it and you said, nobody loves me. That is called a tactile hallucination, a sense of touch, all right? So we all have experienced hallucinations at some point. The people who are most likely to experience a hallucination are senior adults bereaving the loss of a loved one. And approximately 7% of them experience a visual hallucination of that loved one. Now, here's what's interesting. Hallucinations can't occur to groups. There are no group hallucinations. You can have group illusions or delusions, but you can't have a group hallucination. Why? Because a hallucination is going on in your head. It has no external reality, so you can't share it with someone else. It's like a dream. I couldn't wake up my wife in the middle of the night and say, honey, I'm having a dream. I'm in Maui. Go back to sleep. Join me in my dream. Let's have our free vacation. Can't do that, right? She might go back to sleep dream. She's in Maui. I'll go back to sleep dream. I'm in Maui. But we're not having the same dream. Why? Because the dream is going on only here. It has no external reality. I can't share it. You can't have a group dream. You can't have a group hallucination. Now, here's the problem. In the early oral tradition, he appeared to the 12. He appeared to 500, or more than 500 at one time. He appeared to all the apostles. That's three group appearances. That's not a hallucination. He appeared to all of the apostles. He appeared to the 12. We're talking about appearance, that's visual. He appeared to the 12. He appeared to all the apostles. That's 100%, not 7%. And then you have Paul. Paul was a skeptic. He was out persecuting the church. He was arresting Christians, throwing them in prison, and consenting to their execution for being Christians. And then he had an experience he interpreted as the risen Jesus appearing to him. And it radically transformed his life from being a persecutor of the church to one of its most able defenders. Paul, when he's in this condition of persecuting the church, he's not grieving Jesus' death. He believed Jesus was a failed Messiah and a false prophet. So Jesus would have been the last person in the universe that Paul would have expected to see or wanted to see. And it wouldn't account for an empty tomb either, would it? A hallucination. So hallucinations don't work. Let's look at another one. How about the identical twin hypothesis? Okay, do we have any identical twins in here today? Yeah, oh, three of them, how about that? Oh, two of them, both of them. All right, let me ask this person here. Rachel, okay. Cool. Can you and your brother fool people? Okay. Can you fool your parents? No. Is that your wife you're sitting next to?
Yes.
Can your brother fool her?
No.
Okay.
Not normal.
Okay.
Voice-wise, like on the phone.
Voice-wise on the phone, okay. But if you were in person, there were no telephones in the first century. In person.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, you can sit down. Thank you. All right, how about the two of you? Okay, so we've got two identical twins standing next to one another right now. This is awesome. Woo! Okay, let me ask you. Can you guys fool your parents?
Sometimes.
How long can you fool them for? That's the dad saying it, right? Okay, so not long. You could fool people who really didn't know you, right? Okay. Could you fool, what about friends, really good friends? Can you fool them? Okay, for how long? Would you say that again? Same amount of time as your parents, and about for how long do you think? Like if you were talking to them, how long could you fool them?
10 minutes?
That's a pretty long time, okay? That's about the longest I've heard for that. So, okay, let's say 10 minutes. Okay, now, thank you. Remember, now think about it. An identical, I get that same kind of answer all the time. You cannot fool those who really know you for long. These guys, Jesus' disciples, had traveled with him for at least 1.5 years, maybe as long as 3 years. There's no way if there was an identical twin separated from Jesus at birth, and then all of a sudden he appears to the disciples, he's not going to be able to fool them. And you'd have to be a fool to do it anyway. I mean, just think about it. They just saw, this guy had just seen what they did to Jesus, scourged him and crucified him. And I said, hey, guys, look, I'm back. I mean, it's kind of like a guy who gets captured by the conquistadors and says, they say to him, turn over the gold. And he says, I swallowed it. What are you going to do about that? You know, you're not going to do this. Now, there was only one person I know that proposed that Jesus had an identical twin. His name is Greg Cavan. And back in the 1990s, he did his PhD dissertation on this. He's an atheist philosophy professor. And he said, well, it can't be hallucinations. They weren't lying. They really believed Jesus rose and appeared to them. There's only one option that could be here because God doesn't exist. And so the only thing he could be he had to have an identical twin. So that's what he did his doctoral dissertation on, got his PhD. In 2012, I debated him out in California. And before the debate, he said, hey, Mike, during the debate, please do not bring up the twin hypothesis because I don't believe it. So the only person that I know who adopted this doesn't take it anymore. Okay, so we can discount that. So now we're at the apostles claim Jesus rose and appeared to them. He did not appear. They thought that he appeared. We can throw that out. Okay, now we're looking at they did not think he appeared. So now we have two options. They either lied, or when they said he appeared but they knew he didn't appear, they didn't intend to communicate that he actually appeared to them. It was used as a metaphor. Let's start with the lies first, okay? He lied, or they lied and said Jesus rose and appeared to them. We have multiple reports. We have like five or six different reports from the first century alone that talk about how these apostles suffered persecution continuously, were willing to die, and at least some of them did, for their proclamation about Jesus. They were dying for the sake of the gospel. And then after the first century, you have plenty more. Now, some of those may not be reliable. Some may be embellished. Some of them are just fantastic. But we do know that these disciples were willing to suffer continuously for their gospel proclamation. They were willing to die, and we know at least several of them did die for their gospel proclamation. Now, that doesn't mean that what they were proclaiming is true, but it strongly suggests that they sincerely believed what they were proclaiming is true. We know people like Muslims and others who are willing to suffer and die for their beliefs, right? Doesn't mean their beliefs are true, but it does strongly suggest that they are convinced that their beliefs are true. And likewise, the disciples' willingness to suffer continuously, willing to die for their beliefs, strongly suggest that they believed, they were convinced that Jesus had risen and appeared to them. Liars make poor martyrs. So the disciples were not only proclaiming Jesus rose and appeared to them, they actually believed it. So now we can rule out lies. Let's go to the next one, and that's metaphor. Some have said, well, it was just a metaphor that when they said Jesus rose. And by that, what they mean is, he was the first God exalted him in heaven. He wasn't the first. He was just the last to get into a long line of Jewish martyrs. That's what they meant by resurrection. Problem is, there's no evidence for that resurrection ever meant something like that. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 20, Paul says, Christ is the first fruits of those who sleep. He's the first to be raised with a resurrection body, not the just most recent to get into a long line of Jewish martyrs. So we can, and certainly Paul wouldn't have converted to Christianity. He believes that it was God's will to help destroy this movement that Jesus had started. He's not going to change because, you know what, I've just been thinking about it. I like that metaphor of resurrection. So I'm going to give up the eternal destiny of my soul because I like this metaphor. Not going to happen. So we can rule that out. Now that leaves us with another option. Go ahead. He appeared. Jesus' apostles claimed he rose and appeared to them. He actually appeared. But there's two more things. Okay? Maybe he didn't die to begin with. Or maybe he did. Well, crucifixion was an unspeakably cruel process. I wish I could get into the specifics of it with you. I don't have the time for that. But it was so horrible. If you watch the movie The Passion of the Christ, that fairly accurately portrays what it was like. There are a couple things where dramatic license was taken. Scourging scene in that movie, very realistic. Josephus, the Jewish historian, reports on at least two occasions that you could see the bones of a person who had been scourged. They whipped a person to the bone. So it was horrible, and that was just the torture that occurred before crucifixion. The chances of survival were extremely slim. There's only two accounts of it in antiquity of a person surviving crucifixion. In the 5th century BC, a guy named Herodotus reports one guy that was intentionally taken off the cross. But it doesn't say anything about whether he was tortured beforehand or whether he was meant to be left on the cross for execution or any of the details. The other account is Josephus, when during the Jewish war, he saw that three of his friends had been crucified. So he went to his friend, the Roman commander Titus, and asked for a favor. And Titus granted that all three be removed from their crosses and provided the best medical care Rome had could give them at that time. And in spite of that, two of the three still died. So even if Jesus had been removed from his cross prematurely and medically assisted, his chances of survival were extremely slim. But to make it even worse, there's not a scrap of evidence that Jesus was removed while alive or provided any medical care whatsoever, much less Rome's best. So if you're blogging on the internet or on Facebook doing a post, you can propose anything you want. But a historian, it has to be restrained by the evidence. And given all the evidence we have for Jesus' death by crucifixion, without any good evidence to the contrary, the historian at least must conclude that Jesus was crucified and that the process killed him. That leaves us with one other option, and that is that the apostles claimed that he died, rose, and appeared to them. He appeared to them, he died, and he rose. It's the only thing that works. It's the only option there. And that's pretty exciting because it means that God really does love us. It means that Christianity is true. It means that eternal life, the forgiveness of sins, is available to us, that we can have eternal life. And so it means in the end that injustices will be answered, goodness will be rewarded, and death is not final. If you're in here and you've had some bad reports, you got terminal cancer, or you've just had a loved one who died, or you just lost your job, or you had a relationship blow up, folks, this life is just temporary. We got heaven ahead of us. And this is, God doesn't call us to happiness, he calls us to holiness. And he can use this stuff to mold us into better, more Christ-like folks and work it out for our good in that way. So given that, and I close with this, I rewrote the lyrics to Imagine. Imagine there's a heaven. It's easy if you try, where God will meet us and wipe every tear dry. Imagine all the people living in harmony. Imagine there are no tyrants, it isn't hard to do. No one threatening to harm us, and no poverty too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and worship God's holy Son. Now Jesus said it a lot more succinctly and better when he says, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Christ is risen.